but all sat staring at me like as many sheep. "And now, Mr. Silver," I said, "I believe you're the best man here, and if things go the worst, I'll take it kind of you to let the doctor know the way I took it." "I'll bear it in mind," said Silver, with an accent so curious that I could not, for the life of me, decide whether he were laughing at my request or had been favorably affected by my courage. "Well, I have something to say," cried the old mahogany-faced seaman, Morgan by name, who I had seen in Long John's public house upon the quays of Bristol. It was him that knew Black Dog. "Well, and see here," added the sea cook, "it was the same boy that faked the chart from Billy Bones. First and last, we've had to deal with Jim Hawkins." "Then here goes," said Morgan with an oath, and he sprang up, drawing his knife as if he had been 20. "Avast there," cried Silver. "Who are you, Tom Morgan? Maybe you thought you was captain here, but I'll teach you better. Cross me, and you'll go where many a good man's gone before you. Some to the yardarm, some by the board, and all to feed the fishes. There's never a man looked me between the eyes and seen a good day afterward." Morgan paused, but a hoarse murmur rose from the others. "Tom's right," said one. "Did any of you gentlemen want to have it out with me?" roared Silver, bending far forward from his position on the keg, with his pipe still glowing in his right hand. "I'm captain here by election. I'm captain here because I'm the best man by a long sea mile. You won't fight as gentlemen of fortune should, then, by thunder, you'll obey. I like that boy now. I never seen a better boy than that. He's more a man than any pair of rats of you in this here house, and what I say is this. Let me see him that'll lay a hand on him. That's what I say." There's a long pause after this. I stood straight up against the wall, my heart still going like a sledgehammer, but with a ray of hope now shining in my bosom. Silver leaned back against the wall, his arms crossed, his pipe in the corner of his mouth, as calm as though he had been in church. Yet his eye kept wandering furtively, and he kept the tail of it on his unruly followers. They, on their part, drew gradually together toward the far end of the blockhouse, and the low hiss of their whispering sounded in my ear continuously like a stream. One after another they would look up, and the red light of the torch would fall for a second on their nervous faces, but it was not towards me, it was towards Silver that they turned their eyes. "You seem to have a lot to say," remarked Silver, spitting far into the air. "Pipe up and let me hear it, or lay to." "Ask your pardon, sir," returned one of the men. "You're pretty free with some of the rules. Maybe you'll kindly keep an eye upon the rest." "This crew's dissatisfied." "This crew has its rights like other crews, and by your own rules I take it we can talk together. I ask your pardon, sir, acknowledging you to be captain for the present, but I claim my right and step outside for a council." And with an elaborate sea salute, this fellow, a long, ill-looking, yellow-eyed man of 35, stepped coolly toward the door and disappeared out of the house. One after another, the rest followed his example, each making a salute as he passed, each adding some apology. And so, with one remark or another, all marched out, and left Silver and me alone with the torch. The sea cook instantly removed his pipe. "Now look you here, Jim Hawkins," he said in a steady whisper that was no more than audible. "You're within half a plank of death, and what's long sight worse, of torture. They're going to throw me off. But you mark, I stood by you through thick and thin. I didn't mean to, no, not till you spoke up. I was about desperate to lose that much, and be hanged into the bargain. But I see you are the right sort. I say to myself, you stand by Hawkins, and Hawkins'll stand by you. You're his last card, and John, he's yours. Back to back, says I, you save your witness, and he'll save your neck." I began dimly to understand. "You mean all's lost?" I asked. "Aye, by gum I do," he answered. "Ship gone, neck gone, that's the size of it. Once I looked into that bay, Jim, and seen no schooner. Well, I'm tough, but I gave out. As for that lot and their council, mark me, they're outright fools and cowards. I'll save your life, if so be as I can, from them. But see here, Jim, tit for tat, you save Long John from swinging." I was bewildered. It seemed a thing so hopeless he was asking. He, the old buccaneer, the ringleader throughout. "What I can do, that I'll do," I said. "It's a bargain," cried Long John. "You speak up, and by thunder I've got a chance." He hobbled to the torch, where it stood propped among the firewood, and took a fresh light to his pipe. "Understand me, Jim," he said, returning. "I've a head on my shoulders. I'm on Squire's side now. I know you've got that ship safe somewhere. How you done it, I don't know, but I'm sure it's safe. I guess Hans and O'Brien turned soft. I never much believed in either of them. Now, you mark me. I ask no questions, and I won't let others." He drew some cognac from a cask into a tin canakin. "Will you have some?" he asked, and when I had refused, "Well, I'll take a drain myself, Jim," said he. "I need it, for there's trouble on hand." "And talking of trouble, why did the doctor give me the chart, Jim?" My face expressed a wonder so unaffected that he saw the needlessness of further questions. "Ah, well, he did, though," said he. "And there's something under that, no doubt. Something surely under that, Jim, bad or good." And he took another swallow of the brandy, shaking his great fair head like a man who looks forward to the worst.